name is Craig Fitzpatrick, and welcome to 2022. The year can officially start. No Encore is back, and we're making good time. Listen, you know, we've a week head start on the Chinese New Year, so we're laughing. Thank you everyone who's been eagerly anticipating this. Maybe not exactly this, but you know, the show. We had our usual winter break, recharged. We're waiting for new releases. As you, dear listener, and maybe dear Patreon subscriber, we're showless every Friday. But, you know, I know you were saying, listen, we love you, but where's the content? It's all transactional with you guys. But you kept the faith. We're back in 2022. If you want to continue to support the show, patreon.com/noencore. Get the plug in early doors. I really hope you're keeping well and you had a good Christmas and a good break. And there's a few signs that, you know, a better year is coming. Sadly, I must say off the top, it didn't get off to the best of starts for the show family. So if you're obviously wondering why Dave isn't here and doing the kind of intro as he normally would do. And you might know, yeah, that he actually lost his father last week. John Hanratty passed away. Dave is doing as well as can be expected. Not that you can kind of expect anything in these circumstances. But yeah, he seems to be, you know, all good, touch wood. And saw him briefly at the funeral yesterday. He was surrounded by well-wishers. And actually on Saturday as well, for an all-too-rare in-person meetup where... which involved friend of the show, Mayke, serenading us, trying to raise spirits with a loud rendition of the Spice Girls' Viva Forever to us and to the entire Workman's Smoking area, which was tremendous. So heartened was Dave by it that he considered doing the show this week. And we finally saw sense a few days later. And yeah, it was not the week for it, obviously. But next week is going to be the week for it. So he will be back then. We look forward to that. Sleep well, John Hanratty. Thank you for giving us a great friend, great music journalist, podcaster, writer. Dave actually put together a lovely, touching piece. You can check it out on his Twitter, at Hanratty Dave. Please do. I am joined by sonic architect Adam Shanahan. He's back on camera, silent as ever, giving a thumbs up in a plush home studio kind of setup. With a sunlight going, it's zen. It's, you know, the window on the Zoom call is always very zen, but it's like zen window 2.0 at the moment. So yeah, he's there. And also, speaking of great writers, we are joined by music critic. You just heard her there, maybe. Broadcaster extraordinaire. The Sultan of Scandooch. Zara Hederman, back on the mic.
Hello, sorry, Sultan of Scandooch, just ended me there. thanks, Craig, and obviously thinking of Dave and hope he's doing okay and rest in peace, John Hanratty. That was a great introduction, Craig.
It's all downhill from here.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, it's been 2 years with the mic now. Saw you briefly yesterday as well in person. I actually feel far more relaxed now. You know, we have just the screen separating us. Same to you, Adam, as well. Just in-person stuff. I think I'm over it. How about you?
Yeah, no, I can't wait to just get back. The end of year recordings were so nice, just like being in the same room as everyone, having the laughs and having a coffee and a sandwich in the middle between two episodes. I do have a question.
Really good sandwich. Oh yeah, go on, sorry.
I have a question for you. Are you a patron yet?
God damn you. Gosh. No, I am not a Patreon. Although, do you know what? Patron. You are here about a Patreon and a contributor to the show.
And you're a co-host, you know,
in many ways, I'm what would you say? I'm like a content patron. I contribute in terms of creativity, in terms of zest, in terms of my voice, my dulcet tones that, you know, keeps that cash piling up.
Whatever makes you sleep at night, Craig, whatever makes you sleep at night.
I've had a lot of support from people saying you should not be a patron of your own show, Craig, because it doesn't make any sense to get admin tax on your own money. But anyway, listen, that's a discussion for another day and another Dave, and it will run and run. But yeah, is there any kind of, do we need any updates in terms of Zara Land? Are you plugging anything? You never plug anything when you come on the show. You claim you do it for the love of the show, which I'm starting to believe.
Yeah, no, I feel bad plugging anything.
Oh no, by all means.
Let me see. I reviewed the new Silverbacks album for The Quietest that came out to, the review is out today. That album's out tomorrow, or as the listeners listening right now, it's out now. Do finish listening to the episode first and then go and listen to archive material from Silverbacks. But even there, I promoted other people's work. I didn't really promote anything that I'm up to, but just always happy to be the Sultan of Scandooch, spread the good word of Irish music. I have the shakes, Craig. I will tell you that now, and I will warn the listener.
I'm glad you're bringing this up because I didn't know if it was my place. You are dreadfully hungover, I believe. Although you don't seem it, I will say.
That's because I'm not really making eye contact with you that much, Craig.
Nothing new there. Listen, if you can't have a hangover after a funeral, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, exactly. To celebrate the life, right.
You very much do, and I think that's probably our moment to segue into the news. Before we get into the news, I will say we will have our album review, which isn't an album review, it's a mixtape review. That's a great start to the year. FKA Twigs is back. It's basically an album. It's, you know, about 50 minutes long. It's called Capri Songs. I keep thinking Capri Sun in my head, which is, you know, the pouch drink with the straw thing and the fun and the blah blah blah, but we won't talk about Capri Sun. We'll talk about Capri Songs in a little bit. We've got the return of everyone's favorite segment, the return of the vaguely kind of tortured titles of the top five. So this week we have I think we can go with days of the week songs. Does that work? So it's songs with a day of the week in the title. Yeah. And we're not going to be taking this one too seriously. The last one we did was an ode to 1999 Summertime for Humanity. So we might, you know, continue with the frivolousness for the first week back. And yeah, there's lots to talk about in that. There was lots of options. We'll get to it. But before all that, it's the news.
Hey, you heard about the good news?
And yeah, we're now just over a week out from the passing of Ronnie Spector, but it would have felt a bit weird at least not mentioning it. So Ronnie Spector, just kind of 1960s pop icon, who had a number of humongous hits, not least Be My Baby, has passed away. She was 78. Statement from her family read, "Our beloved Earth Angel Ronnie peacefully left this world today after a brief battle with cancer. She was with family and in the arms of her husband Jonathan. Ronnie lived her life with a twinkle in her eye, spunky attitude, a wicked sense of humour and a smile on her face." And what a tremendous voice. Zara, you know, I think you were kind of, I remember, it might have been actually one of your tweets where I saw the news breaking and I was kind of knocked for six just because you're just losing another person. A tremendously influential voice. Archetype, I guess. Just seems like so many roads lead back to Ronnie Spector, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was really sad to hear the news of her death because news didn't come out of her even being ill at all.
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously, like that voice is just so synonymous with the 60s girl group movement and then kind of throughout just how we saw people like Amy Winehouse in the mid 2000s just being really influenced by her and trying to not like emulate the sound but I guess kind of carry that sound and that torch in a different kind of era. She's a fascinating figure. I remember when I was a teenager really getting into the Ronettes. It was like the only kind of music I listened to for a good period while all my friends like were getting into Baby Shambles and Dirty Pretty Things. I was listening to maudlin music about teenage love.
You know what, Sarah? I think I was doing both, so it's a pity we weren't friends.
So it's really sad. Obviously, Be My Baby is such a, to use the horrendous word, iconic song, but it is such a huge part in films like Mean Streets and obviously Dirty Dancing. But I read her memoir, How I Survived Mascara, Miniskirts and Madness, amazing title.
Yeah,
like really 2 years ago at the start of the pandemic, And to this day, it is the greatest music memoir I've ever read in my life.
Really? Okay.
Oh my God, Craig, you have to read it. She's so funny. Her stories are incredible. Like when she was, when the Ronettes went on tour with the Beatles and like partied with them for a little bit. She had a little bit of a romance with John Lennon. There's a hilarious dalliance with Bowie. And then there's just like a terrifying birth story that she shares, which just completely put me off children full stop. But no, it's a really great book. I highly, highly recommend it, especially kind of on the back of her death. So yeah, rest in power to Ronnie Spector.
Yeah, for sure. I need to check that out. I need to do some digging as well, just in terms of her musical career beyond the 60s, because it does, like, obviously a lot of people have been coming out and saying, you know, need to shine a spotlight on the stuff she did thereafter, which, to be honest, I don't know a huge amount about, but yeah, I'm going to do a little digging.
It's not great, I will tell you that.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. So Alexis Petridis, and mark that off your bingo cards, your show bingo cards, wrote a piece in The Guardian, was like, don't be sleeping on this stuff. I've heard, I think the most I've heard is like she covered like a few Ramones songs, which immediately further endeared me to her, but they didn't sound amazing. So I was like, it seemed like a varied career. Is that the polite way of saying it?
Like,
I,
yeah, you know, just absolutely. Like
curios and stuff.
Yeah, I think it was like 71. She did go into the studio with George Harrison and Phil Spector, obviously, was when she was still married to him. And George had written the song Try Some, Buy Some, and she recorded it. And John Lennon and George were playing on the song. And it was released, but it didn't really do anything. George then re-recorded it, released it himself. But there was supposed to be an album, a Ronnie Spector album, put out through Apple from those sessions. And it just never saw the light of day, pretty much because of Phil Spector, which is... classic.
That really makes me think less of Phil Spector, I have to say. And I had such a high opinion of the guy. No, fuck Phil Spector, of course. First gaffe of the new year. But yeah, it's, yeah, rest in power, as you say. I did see way less important news of Brockhampton breaking up as well, which was like probably something we should mention, which was not least because they were due to play the Primavera that I was supposed to be going to for the last 2 or 3 years. So they didn't manage to survive as a group all of those delays. And I was also thinking about it, and I believe their entire recorded career happened in the time since Frank Ocean last released an album. So yeah, wild ride for Brockhampton. They are no more. If you're going to Primavera like me, maybe this summer, they will not be there.
So are you hopeful that you are going to get to Primavera this year?
I think so. No, is that a little too optimistic?
I don't think so. I think you're going to have to.
Sounds vaguely patronising. It's good to have hope, Craig, you know. Just like last year and the year before that.
You know who doesn't have hope or belief in themselves?
Go on.
Bono, and you hit the music of YouTube. What
a segue. Tremendous. Thank you. First segue of the year. Really good. Even if it was a lie about, and I think this, all these quotes are kind of a lie. So the headline reads, Bono dislikes U2's name and most of their songs. So he was on some...
So bad.
Yeah, I know. He was on some random podcast. It's like a Times podcast, awards chatter. And I don't know why he's pitching up on that one. He explained that he turns off the radio when U2's songs are played because he can't listen to his vocals. And he's claimed that he only learned how to sing recently. I've seen him say that before. And it was probably Q interviews in like 2004. Where he's just like, I don't know, he's always got an angle, he's always got a hook, I don't know. He's a salesman. But anyway, first of all, he said he still doesn't like U2's band name. The quote from Bono reads, I really don't, but I was late into some kind of dyslexia. I'm not sure about that. I didn't realise that the Beatles was a bad pun either. Fair enough. In our head, it was like the spy plane, U-boat. It was futuristic, as it turned out to imply this kind of acquiescence. No, I don't like that name. I still don't really like the name. Paul McGuinness, our first manager, did say, look, it's a great name. It's going to look good in a t-shirt, a letter, and a number. I think it's a pretty good name, right? I mean, it could have been...
It's a good name.
Yeah.
It's short, it's snappy. Visually, I think it looks good. And I also think that, like, visually it does, I think, look like a rock band.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best things about them. I mean, it's, you know, it beats, I get his point on the kind of U2 thing, which, to be honest, when you hear U2, the band name, you just think U2, the band at this point, which is probably a testament to their success. But it could have been, in terms of like, you know, innocent double entendres, it's better than UB40. I don't think that's a double entendre, really, is it? It could be. It could be like you. It could be a command to be middle aged, same as the B52s. B52. I don't know. I think U2 is a good band name, but when he was going on to talk about his voice, he said that years back, Robert Palmer told bassist Adam Clayton, "God, would you ever tell your singer to just take the keys down a little bit? He'd do himself a favor, and he'd do all of us a favor who have to listen to him."
So good.
Yeah, so Bono was saying, "I was thinking out of my body. I wasn't thinking about singing. I didn't really think about changing keys. Did we ever change a key?"
I think the thing that I found quite funny as well about this story was in the interview, he said that like a lot of his vocal performances make him cringe. And he said that their 2004 single Vertigo is probably the one I'm most proud of.
Most proud? Yeah. Which I actually like Vertigo, but so many people just loathe that song.
Yeah, like I liked it too, but then I was thinking about like all of the other amazing vocal performances from Bono over the years. And I think like stuff like Stay, Far Away, So Close is great. Who's Gonna Ride Your Odd Horses? I think that's amazing.
Brilliant. Yeah. Lemon, like I love when he does that kind of falsetto leap. I think he's actually, all jokes aside, I think he's a great singer, to be honest.
Exactly. Especially because when you think about how U2 started out and their sound then was a lot kind of choppier and punkier. So like he didn't really need to have like a good voice necessarily for the songs that they were delivering, but I do always think that he did a fair job of like sounding decent. I'd never really had any problem with his voice before, but I did find this like also quite funny how like of all the things that he's given out about U2 and how embarrassed he is about like his career, the one thing that he didn't say that he was embarrassed about was that his nickname, and he's known as Bono. Like I think that's pretty mortifying.
Do you know what's slightly more mortifying as a nickname? The Edge. Imagine, come on, like, imagine being in your 60s and you're The Edge.
Particularly when you're just sure Larry Mullen Jr. and Adam Clayton are so happy.
Yeah, really. Because, you know, did they actually have nicknames to begin with and they dropped them, or were they just not that ridiculous to begin with? I'm going to guess the latter. But that was a close call.
Yeah.
I can't really picture Larry going along with, I don't know, Bongo or something.
Because they just seem so normal. Like,
doesn't Bono, you know, apart from being called Bono, when he does that thing when they're writing songs where he just sings melodies without words, doesn't he call that Bonglies or something as well? He's got like his own name for his way of just singing nonsense and gibberish. I think he calls it Bonglies, which I love.
There's like a video of this, something like Bono teaches you Bongolese. That would be an amazing watch.
That would be amazing masterclass, yeah. There's a quote from Bono in this as well, where he goes, "I do think U2 pushes out the boat on embarrassment quite a lot. Maybe that's the place to be as an artist, you know, right at the edge of your level of embarrassment," which we have said on this show quite a bit when talking about U2, I think, where it's like, yes, they can be utterly cringe, they can get it horribly wrong, but actually they kind of take those chances and fall flat on their face sometimes, but that's kind of where the ambitious kind of big widescreen amazing U2 moments, and there's, you know, a good few of them, come from. So cut yourself some slack, Bono. Take it easy on yourself, pay some taxes, and yeah, that's it. Okay, let's move right along to another big ego who's, you know, coming back down to earth, I guess you would say. Unless we're thinking of his many so apparent encounters with UFOs. It's Robbie Williams.
I was wondering which of the two news stories you were going to go to, whether it was going to be Robbie or possibly the next one that we're going to talk about.
Oh, yeah, we've got a nice trio. Little teaser there. It is Robbie Williams. He's revealed that at the height of his fame, there was a hitman hired to kill him. Now, I don't want to kind of make... I know. This is like, okay. So he's made some outlandish claims over the years. I mean, you know, just the aforementioned UFO stuff. I don't think he's quite as credible as Tom DeLonge on that, for instance. I've done the research, I've looked into it, and I'm sorry, Robbie. But this one is... He was doing an interview with The Mirror, first of all. I'm like, Robbie, why'd you have to do that at this point? Like, and actually, the few times I've seen him interviewed in recent years, he comes across as quite self-aware now, and he's been working on himself, and he seems like a perfectly nice chap. So if this is true, this would be extremely scary. The quote goes, "I've never ever said this, but I had a contract put on me to kill me. I've never said that publicly before. It went away. I have friends."
I love that line so much.
Friends. Is he talking about little aliens? Yeah. I don't know.
Does he think he's Tony Soprano as well? Like,
I mean, I guess he knows some people, right? He probably... that stuff is the unseen stuff that happens when you become famous. And my thought was like, is it? Because obviously, you know, having your life threatened when you're mega famous is a very, very real thing. And there's unhinged people and there's stalkers and it must be extremely scary. But generally, those unhinged stalkers don't have the ways and means to hire a hitman. I've always assumed a hitman has a certain code of ethics. Do you know what I mean? Do they just, maybe I'm being naive here, do they just take any job? Would they not go, listen, you need to get over your grievances with Robbie Williams. He's left, take that. It's no reason to kill the man. I'm not taking this hit. Maybe not. Maybe they're just mercenaries for hire. Actually, that's exactly what they are. They're hitmen. Do you believe this story, Zara? Who do you think, this is a bigger question, who do you think wanted to kill Robbie Williams at the height of his fame? So what, 1999 maybe? Oh, this is a big accusation. And we should point out, legally, a joking one on this comedy podcast about confirmed Tory Gary Barlow, who at that time would have been, would have had, you know, a lot of, they've since made up. Gary Barlow's career has since come back, but at the height of Robbie Williams' fame, yeah, I guess Gary Barlow was in the doldrums. Was he in the doldrums enough that he would have put out a hit on? I don't think so. I think the man who wrote Back for Good can't wish any ill on anyone, can he?
Oh, smoke and mirrors. That's all like just part of the good boy persona, I think. I'd say if he like looked in, I'd say Gary Barlow at one point possibly would have been like, especially as Robbie Williams says here, when he had his solo career, he sold 80 million albums and he held the record for the most tickets sold in a day for a tour. So I'd say Gary was like at home pretty jealous about that. Like, even if Gary was at home getting the like bones of like patience together or something like that, I could imagine that he would get ticked off enough to like want to take Robbie Williams out. Especially because like, always think that like, people loved Robbie the most in Take That because he had the edge. He was like, he was the Shane Lynch of Take That. Where like,
I think you'll find Shane Lynch was the Robbie Williams of Boyzone. No, that's very harsh on Robbie Williams.
He's a legend, I think.
He's a bit of a legend, is he? I would have said Keith Duffy was more the, he was a bit more of a cheeky chappy, right? Was Shane Lynch not a bit more serious and kind of like streetwise and streetwise dancer on the Late Late Show? I don't know.
Keith Duffy, I'd say though, is more Jason Orange, maybe. Oh. Like, he was a bit more silent during Boyzone's tenure, but then like later on, like Keith Duffy was in Coronation Street and wasn't Jason Orange? Didn't Jason Orange have like an acting...
Really? I thought Jason Orange was all shy and retiring. Adam was agreeing with you. Adam is now saying Stephen Gately was Jason Orange, which I think is probably a fair shout. Although I would have thought Gately was Marcone.
Yeah, no. Gately was Marcone. I actually completely forgot about Marcone there.
They don't compare. Take That forever. Even if Gary Barlow took out a hit on Robbie Williams, it doesn't tarnish the music for me. And never had any great love for Boyzone. Go on. You loved what, Boyzone?
I quite enjoyed the part B of this news story.
Yeah, let's get to it. It gets very Partridge.
Yeah, to say I loved is probably not fair on Robbie Williams and what he was going through at the time.
As opposed to his entire segment so far. We say this with all love for Rob Williams, but it does get very Partridge-esque. So, yeah, the headline. Robbie Williams recalls gorging on $32 worth of chocolate while asleep. And I love that the news story has in brackets the sterling currency translation or conversion. 28 of your Queen's English pounds, British pounds. So yeah, this more quotes from Robbie revealing all. Because of Ambien, he said, I ate $32 worth of chocolate. I love that he has the monetary value on the chocolate, asleep, completely asleep. So he listen, he suffers from insomnia and he's battled, you know, drug and alcohol addictions, and he's spoken quite candidly about that, and we wish him well. But yeah, he said he had this sleeping disorder at one point during his 2007 tour, Close Encounters, Back to the UFOs, which I love. Or he said he would eat like a monk in the day, but then when he was kind of out of it, he'd finish off the minibar at night. So he said then at night I'd be taking these Ambien and then I would be eating the minibar, be eating the menu, don't remember any of it, which is yeah, perfectly plausible thing on Ambien. Those things can be very scary. Speaking of scary, he also gave his security staff a fright by sleep talking to them while stark naked. Oh, he was on a different podcast for this. Oh, maybe this was the same podcast. No, what was this? Okay. Yeah, so one was a Mirror article, which actually, do you know what? The Mirror article was probably just quoting the past weekend podcast, so getting that straight there. And he said, yeah, my security on tour, they'd have the Ambien. I'd be like, can I have them? So they give me it, and then I'd go next door, and then I'd have my Ambien. I'd fall asleep in the Ambien, and then I would get up completely naked, go through the security room and have a conversation with them as lucidly as this, but completely naked and asleep. Then I'd wake up the next morning and I'd say, I didn't do it, did I? And then this look in their eyes would just be like, yes, you did. You did do it.
Such a scary thought, obviously, as well. Just like the effects that Ambien would probably have on your body over like continued usage. But like also just like the fact that he was eating while he said he was completely asleep. That's so dangerous. Like you could have choked on. Now, obviously, chocolate would melt kind of decently in your mouth while you're eating it, but at the same time it could have been a chocolate with nuts or like other kind of things in it that could obviously cause some kind of hazard. While I was found aspects of it, like the details, not funny, but like just the amount, the $32, and then just the image of Robbie Williams sleep talking stark naked, something I can't unsee now actually when I'm talking, but
we'll try to unsee it and we can move on. We wish Robbie Williams all the very, very best.
Yeah,
he's managed to dodge anything on Ambien. Where are you going? Do you know what? I once built my own burial chamber under a church on the grounds of my estate while I was on Ambien. No, sorry, that wasn't me. That was maybe Ed Sheeran, who has submitted proposals.
What a link. Oh my God.
To build a burial chamber under a private church on his Suffolk estate. He's submitted these proposals, we should say, entirely lucidly. So the plans for, first of all, a boat-shaped church. This wasn't just like a little chapel that happened to be there on the grounds of the estate. No, it's a place of retreat for contemplation and prayer for Sheeran. Has been amended to include the burial space now. submitted to Dennington Parish Council in December. And yeah, I don't really know what to say about it. There's a lot going on with this. So I knew he had a massive, weird kind of gaffe. The property is called Sheeranville, which is great. Has a main house, Winnie's Hall, which he bought about a decade ago now. It's got three adjacent houses. I knew it had it's got a pub in the converted barn. It's got a fruit orchard, which is very nice. Heart-shaped pond. Luxury treehouse, which is great. Recording studio, obviously, where he does all this crap music. And a greenhouse. Do you know, his last album wasn't bad. As well as an indoor swimming pool and a fitness complex. And I don't know, how do we feel about this plan for a burial chamber? Because I guess, you know, thinking ahead, if you're Ed Sheeran and you've got so much money, you've got Sheeranville, you're thinking ahead of your like legacy, you're probably like, it just feels very throwback English kind of lord thing of just like generations upon generations will lay to rest on the grounds of my estate that I have built from nothing. And to me, it doesn't scream man of the people. It's the only point I would make, Sarah.
Yeah, this story depressed me on a number of levels because like even just the detail of his private estate and some of the things that he has, like the pub, not so much the treehouse, that's pretty cool, but like to also have the recording studio, an indoor swimming pool and a fitness complex. It just made me think that about how he's just had to develop this little personal village.
Yeah.
And I was like, I wonder, is that because of the levels of fame he has, he can't go anywhere for a quiet pint because it'll just end up on like the front page of the Daily Mail or something like that. And then adding the burial chamber too, it just seems like a really grim continuation of that. Like,
yeah, it's a bit too all in one, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I also thought it was like, I know he's put in permission or whatever, but I thought it was illegal to bury a body on a like domestic dwelling. I didn't think you could do that.
That's,
but I guess
interesting.
If you're a bajillionaire, you probably can, because there's no...
Yeah, and maybe if the grounds are like, there's different kind of designations for parts of the ground or something. I don't know. Maybe with the church thing, he's going to become his own religion. Maybe that's the next step, Red. I don't know. Listen,
it did.
Whatever
it did
makes
also
him happy.
Just, it made him seem kind of selfish because I'm sure when he does die, I'm sure fans would like to go visit his grave, like a kind of graceland.
Maybe he's going to open the whole thing up. Maybe he is a man of the people and it's not going to be where the Sheerans live for the next 500 years. It's just going to become this amazing place where people can, they can go to the pub, they can maybe do some recording, they can have a swim and they can go to the graveyard. I don't know. It's all very strange.
Kind of genius then, if he is building a Graceland kind of empire, because then when he dies, obviously his estate will be they're probably well set up anyway, but they're going to be even more so set up if Sheeranville is just the new Graceland.
You have to employ a lot of, I don't know, the consideration there has to be that he is going to be seen in the same light as Elvis Presley. I don't know. Maybe wishful thinking. We'll never know. We probably won't find out because that's not even news. That's far, far in the future. Do you know what is news, Sarah? Something far, far in the past. It's time for Dave, if he's still listening, to roll his eyes because it's Steely Dan news.
Girl.
Our beloved Steely Dan. This is a nice story. I like this. It mainly because it involves something not great happening to one of the Eagles. Don Henley of the Eagles almost appeared, which I didn't know, on Steely Dan's 1977 hit Peg before he was fired by Steely Dan, according to the band's producer, Gary Katz. I guess paving the way for Michael McDonald's amazing vocals on Peg. What a legend that man is, and everything worked out. But yeah, there was this new interview with Gary Katz, and he was talking about how, in the chorus, the background's sort of the lead, which we will all, we all know Peg, of course. Absolute classic. Wasn't like a usual background part, says Katz. So Steely Dan were kind of putting the track together. Katz and Don Fagan were discussing how they both liked Don Henley singing. They decided to bring him in with Linda Ronstadt to track some vocals for the song. So I think Linda Ronstadt didn't arrive, she wasn't feeling well, so Nicolette Larson came as well. However, when it came time for Henley to learn the parts, Fagan wanted them to sing, results weren't great. So the quote from Katz is, "There wasn't patience as much as instant reaction of the realities of the moment. We didn't jerk people off by letting them think it was going to work and have them sit for 2 hours. Fair. When we knew it wasn't going to be okay, Fagan would tell me to end it. So they sang it again and it was no good." Not long after, Fagan signaled for bandmate Walter Becker to go get a sandwich with him. They both backed off. I love it. As they were leaving the studio, Katz said Fagan told him to fire Henley at Larson. And Kat said the command left him with my finger up my ass having to fire Henley, which I did, and have heard about for 35 years since in various ways, which I can well believe.
Yeah,
and so elaborating on what he meant, Kat said, "The last time I saw Henley, he sidled up to me," which I guess is how Don Henley approaches everyone, I would assume, Zara. Just sidles up to you. And he said, "You gonna fire me again today, Katz? but he didn't smile when he said it. I love it.
So uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I knew about the kind of, there was like a playful rivalry between Steely Dan and the Eagles, and, you know, there's lyrics about turning up the Eagles because the neighbours are listening or whatever in a Steely Dan song, and they just kind of had a bit of back and forth. But apparently they were kind of hanging out in LA, bit of rivalry back in the day. Obviously one far superior band. The Eagles were trash, like the Doors, and end of discussions. Ara, do you agree?
Yeah, no, you pretty summed it up there. I have no dispute there. Steely Dan rule. Eagles are terrible. Doors, well, no even point commenting. Like, they're a woeful band.
Okay. Yeah, let's find out. Oh, sorry. Go on, Zara.
No, it's just the sandwich detail where you just killed me. I just, that image of them going to like a deli. I loved it.
So great. Okay, let's find out your feelings on this artist. Hit it, Adam.
Attention, everyone. One.
Shut up.
Craig on Kanye.
Yeah, which should be Craig on Ye, I guess, at this point. And do you know what? I'm looking at the nearly 2 pages of notes we have on everything Ye's been up to since the show went on hiatus. I don't know if I can do it, Zara. I don't know if there's anything you want to say about it, but...
Kind of Craig on Kanye. But Craig,
a lot's been going on. A lot's been going on. There's 2 quotes I want to call to people's attention. Just, we're cutting through the nonsense around Ye at the moment, and there's 2 quotes. There's one direct quote from Ye where he says, "I haven't been the best Christian," which is fair enough. Kind of sums up a lot. And there's another quote from this guy who was doing an interview with him recently where he said, "He's been in the studio every day for hours on hours on hours working on..."
Don't say it, you, baby.
It's happening. It's happening. Watch this space. And that is Craig on Ye. And that's the end of the news. So it is album/mixtape review time. It's a good one to come back on. It's a big name. It's FK Twigs. And here's the opener from Capri Songs. It's Ride the Dragon. Cause I've been the opener there from Capri Songs, 17 track strong mixtape. It is the follow-up to Magdalene, which is a proper LP released about 2-ish years ago. This kind of came out of the blue-ish for me. I know we'd had the song with The Weeknd feature, Tears in the Club, and she'd been working on stuff, but I think we got maybe a week lead in with the PR thing. And I guess the conversation around this is that it's FKA Twigs trying something a bit different. So for people that aren't up to speed with FKA Twigs, I guess she came to people's attention about a decade ago at this point with EP1, really marked her out as a major talent, South London based artist, songwriter, producer, dancer, multi-talent. EP2 followed and was similarly tremendous. And then we got LP1, which like continued the prosaic names. But yeah, the music within was anything but. So just really shape-shifting stuff, risk-taking pop. Can't really throw enough superlatives at it. She kind of kept busy thereafter on screen doing songs for the next few years. But it was a 5-year wait until 2019's Magdalene, which was definitely worth it. I believe it was No Encore's album of that year, so all that effort really paid off, Twigs. And it was an intense listen. Like, it was documenting this, I guess, all-encompassing heartbreak on a personal level. Just really simple kind of piano lines acting as these foundations for quite like operatic examinations of the soul. It was fractured and it was interesting. And yeah, it was kind of, for me, something for the ages from subject matter that, you know, others had kind of mined for tabloid headlines around her. Which will probably happen again with this very, very different release. And this is her finding a bit of joy and finding a lot of hope. It's kind of carnal. It's feel good. the artist herself has put out a statement, maybe just kind of cherry pick a few quotes from it. So Twig says, in the first lockdown, I called around my team hinting that maybe I'd hit the end of the road making music and putting my insides on blast, how I have done for the last few years. Felt nice playing with the idea of not creating for the world. So instead, she says, I listened to podcasts. I spoke to my friends loads on FaceTime. Isolating alone, I would pop my girlfriends on loudspeaker and pot around my house listening to them natter on about this and that. So she goes on to say essentially that this kind of period of isolation but connecting with people online led her to open up a bit more to, you know, working in collaboration with people kind of for the first time. She was recording her friends talking as well simultaneously and weaving it throughout this kind of building mixtape, like a kind of narrative of her healing, she says. And yeah, I feel like maybe with this mixtape she's encroaching on our territory. It could almost be a podcast, could it? We don't need that kind of rivalry. And it's what she's saying is her response to where the world has been at in recent times. To me, it sounds very like of the moment in terms of, you know, we could roll our eyes at like, oh, here's another pandemic album, but it doesn't feel like it's kind of, it's ready to get a post-pandemic party started. It's an album for kind of cutting yourself some slack, maybe getting back together. It does feel quite communal to me. Zara, how did it strike you? How did you get on with this mixtape?
I would really like FKA Twigs' music, especially Magdalene. Yeah. I thought that album was just exceptional. It's such a, even though it's quite a sparse album, it's such a warm listen as well in a weird way. This mixtape, sorry, I was intrigued by it, I will say, especially like seeing some of the reviews that were coming out and saying that like it was kind of less experimental than we're used to from her. It was a bit more of a shift towards the mainstream, which I think was definitely evident with Tears in the Club. Even like my listens to the mixtape this week, that song in particular just really made me hear that more as a weekend song than a FKA Twigs song.
Okay.
And that was like something that I struggled with a little bit with this album. I do think that the song that we heard there, Ride the Dragon, it's really interesting. The production is really nice. The beats are really engaging. And then there are some other moments like Meta Angel, which I think is a really great song. Yeah. It's one of my standouts. Which Way is interesting too. But I just kind of felt that there was a lot of bloat on this mixtape. And kind of going back to what you were saying of like, it sounded very off the moment. It certainly does. And even down to the kind of voice note inclusions, like punctuating the mixtape and like serving as like little interludes or introductions or outros even. Like we've heard that kind of style from, say, Self-Esteem. It also reminded me a lot of maybe like Little Sims in a different kind of way. And yeah. I think just
even Adele recently with the kind of voice notes about her.
Yeah, I haven't listened to that album, so I can't comment on that.
Big release. Everyone's talking about it.
I'll check it out. But I just found that the sort of like camouflaging and like settling in so well to like the perceived sound of the moment was a really off-putting thing for me, because that is what I really loved about her previous releases, is that they stood out so much from what everyone else was doing. And it's weird then hearing her do like a very Grimes 2012 like Visions era song on like Which Way, which Mike Dean has a songwriting credit on as well.
Yeah, Mike Dean's on it, and there's
Warren Ellis is on it.
Warren Ellis is on like a kind of interlude almost. There's a huge amount of collaborations going on here, and at times you're like, is she kind of squandering great music buried underneath where it's this kind of like just chatter over it of her mates talking about like, you know, very banal kind of love yourself platitudes, are just stuff that it seems surface level. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it didn't entirely work for me, because even though there are some you know, really nice, spacious arrangements, and she really lets all the textures and tones speak for themselves a lot. And she also explores, say, like dance hall music, a lot more R&B style, some kind of straight run-of-the-mill pop. I found, and even though it is actually, it's 17 songs, but it's 48 minutes, so it's like a standard album length that we're used to. I found this felt so long, and by my kind of fourth, fifth listen, I was really getting tired of it. And I was looking forward to not have to go back to it. Like, there are songs that I really liked, say like Meta Angel, Ride the Dragon, Oh My Love, I think is great. I quite like the closing song, Panky Song. But I can't imagine myself listening to this from start to finish again, because even though there are big sounds within its minimalism, it just felt quite thin and not even indulgent, because there is actually some nice personality and personable moments throughout, but it's not a record I enjoyed spending time with. What about you?
That's really interesting, because I had the exact opposite experience. Just because it is, you're bang on, it's like an album where, you know, she's dabbling in genres and stuff, or diving into the mainstream for maybe the first proper time. But to me, it still all felt very Twigs. You know, it's an album of features, but it still felt kind of all Twigs. Even on the, you know, the Weekend feature, which I thought worked kind of pretty well, or better in the context of the album. When it cuts to Big Abel, he's kind of putting the spotlight back on her. It's still her perspective, and he's just, it struck me listening to it in its entirety that she's the focus. It's almost like she's moving through this kind of party. The camera's on her, and you're getting fleeting glimpses of other people, or just kind of cameos. And that to me was a good thing, because going into this, I was like gearing up to not particularly like it. And certainly all the voice note stuff, I mean, really, if I look at it logically and break it down, I'm like, this could be nails on chalkboard stuff. I could find this deeply infuriating. We all know, long-time listeners to the show will know, I loathe a skit. It's ruined as many great albums as it's improved. It's just like none. And so many of these are like, we're really into, you know, my Facebook story territory, which, you know, it's my one issue with Frank Ocean's Blonde. It's all that kind of chatter. But I think actually the overall tone of the record, it's quite tongue-in-cheek. I feel like it's meta. Like, you know, with Magdalene, where she was very much examining herself and kind of then womanhood to a wider extent, and she was kind of manipulating her own image and like the archetype of womanhood and playing around with that as a concept. With this, it feels like she's, like, it is an album, but she's playing around with this mixtape kind of party playlist kind of world, and she's giving her own kind of commentary and twist on that thing. And she's kind of using it as like another mask. Although I do think she was very open, particularly on the closing track. And just kind of like, it's a new way for her to funnel her energy. I just thought the songs were really strong. Like, Meta Angel, I love. But even some more of the bangers, like a track like when she's dipping into dancehall, like Pappy Bones, I was like, this is exactly the kind of song that I would normally just be like, this is not doing anything for me. It's fine, but it's not working. And I was kind of nearly like halfway through the album, out for a run with the record, or sorry, the mixtape, and really enjoying it thus far. And it was like, as that was kicking in, I'm like, this probably isn't going to be one for me. And then halfway through, I'm like, this is very much for me, because I thought the melodies throughout, on every layer, on every instrument, on all of the vocals, felt strong to me. And I replayed Pappy Bones about 3 times in a row, because I was like, it actually, the best thing about it is the final third. And there's a few songs where I was thinking, the hooks keep building as the song progressed to my ears, to the extent that I was like, you could kind of dismiss this record as a bit thin and being like, okay, she kind of threw it together, just, you know, something that was really working for her at the time, and it was like spur of the moment thing. But there's clearly a lot of like work that's gone into this, and I felt like the quality of the songwriting was there. Bear in mind, as you say, yeah, there is, you know, she is dabbling in styles that if it's going to, you know, rub you the wrong way at all, it might scupper some of the stuff. I completely get the opinion that like she's been doing such singular daring stuff that to suddenly turn her attention to more kind of crowded lanes where, you know, some of the best stuff on this, it could be a kind of Charlie XCX song. It's like, is that what we kind of need or want from Twigs? But to me, shockingly, against all odds, it turned out what I kind of needed. And it kind of put me in a good mood this week. Like, it really did. It felt like, okay, maybe we're coming out of like the new normal or whatever. It felt very generous as a record. It felt frivolous in all the current kind of right ways where it just wasn't, it kind of was wearing all its influences and its features quite lightly. And I just think that's a testament to her kind of skills. So, I mean, maybe I know you're kind of in agreement that there is a number of songs in this that are particularly strong. I thought, you know, even the kind of more tied together moments didn't really lag. The short kind of tracks, like that vibe of it being, you know, 17 tracks, it had that kind of like, almost like a White Album vibe where it's just like, it's a lengthy enough record, but there's so much switch ups that it actually didn't drag to me, unlike your experience. And actually, yeah, I really got on with this. I think I'll go back to it a fair bit. And I'm kind of surprised as you probably are, but that was my experience with it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Cause like there was just, I found like when I was kind of making my notes on certain songs, like Poppy Bones, I just kind of like, while it is like really infectious and it does kind of get into your skin a bit and it does get you like in a zone, I just kind of felt that like it was a bit of a copy paste job of a dancehall track. Like I kind of felt like I'd heard a song similar to it. It just didn't have any kind of individuality to me. And I get, like, obviously Twigs' presence is the individuality because her voice is kind of unparalleled. Nobody can sing like her. And I love the acrobatics that she can do with her voice and how she uses it. But there was just so many times where I kind of felt like, I feel like I've heard this arrangement before. And just going back to some of the people who had the songwriting credits, like Mike Dean and Lauren Ellis, I just felt that like to have those people in particular and not have their kind of distinct style come out more just felt like a bit of a waste.
The Lauren Ellis thing did really throw me. So I this, because there's like it didn't seem that indulgent to me because I felt that there's a lot of ideas there and there's a lot of strong melodies and there's a lot of really interesting production layers and stuff of like, I can imagine if there were certain bits you kind of really loved going, oh, well, this is one direction she could have amplified and made her soul focus and made more of a Twigs different thing. So I can understand the frustration of being, you know, her, she's kind of like skimming across the surface of a load of different styles and, you know, trying on different things. And it's certainly not that cohesive, apart from the kind of the dressing of it being a mixtape and the increasingly infuriating voice notes that somehow kind of work for me. So I can understand how we just hold her in such high regard, I guess. And we're kind of like patiently awaiting her next move. And it feels like every new kind of big release should be this grand statement because she's so capable of it. And this isn't that. So,
no.
Yeah. Yeah. But I had a lot of fun with it. And I had my fun, Zara. And that's all.
Numerically, how does that fun look?
I'm going to give this an 8. I really got on with it. I think, you know, we're probably in agreement that I think if people give it at least one listen, you'll probably find a handful of songs that you'll take away anyway and put in your own mixtape, you know?
Yeah.
So what would your rating out of 10 be?
6.
Okay. Not bad. But not quite good enough, unfortunately, for FKA Twigs. But do you know what, actually, just
any time, I'm sure.
Yeah. Before we wrap up on it, like, there seems to be, you know, from what she's saying, this was recorded over a fair amount of time, but there seemed to be some murmurings of she had something else kind of prepared that she felt was a bit heavy. And then this came together quite quickly. And I'm not sure if I agree with that, but do you feel like this felt like a lighter thing that she just had fun doing and that actually maybe there was a grander work that we haven't heard as yet?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. No, well, sure. Well, maybe that will arrive. And when it does, we will review it on this show. You can count on that. So that's our album review of Mixtape. And let's move on to our final segment of the first show of 2022. And it's a biggie. It's our top five. It's our top five days of the week songs. So, Zara, criteria-wise, you asked me, and I actually, hold on, we should get to the origins of the days of the week thing. So I can't quite remember because it gets quite convoluted when we try and come up with these things. I think it was because this week had Blue Monday in it.
Oh yeah, I was thinking of
Blue Monday teams, and then it's like, oh, Monday's a day of the week. We could do days of the week songs. And you were like, what's the criteria? And I said, it has to have a day of the week in the title. So we're going to be rigorous about that, Zara. No, like, weekends or any of this kind of stuff or allusions, right? Is that cool?
What? We're going to have weekend?
No, you can have like Saturday or Sunday.
Oh my God.
But you can have like something for the weekend. Do you know?
Sorry.
Because I did give that consideration. I had a sleepless night about that, of course.
Yeah. Or 8 days a week by the Beatles.
Exactly. So What have we got? We've got Monday. We've got Tuesday. You've got Wednesday as well. Thursday. And then you've got your Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
And kind of in that vein, I was really sad that I couldn't have Craig David 7 days. Because like it fits almost the criteria.
Yeah, devastating news.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. I was trying to work to a thing where I was going to be like, okay, I'm just picking, you know, only like you can only have a track for one particular day. And I said that to you yesterday and you're like, life's too short, Craig. So actually I dispensed with that. You inspired me to live in the moment. So let's kick off with your number five as guest co-host, Sarah. What have you got for us?
Okay, so kind of aptly to start off my top five, we're going to go to the very start of the week. So Adam, if you would like to press play.
Monday, Monday, so good to me. Monday morning, it was all I hoped it would be. Oh, Monday morning, Monday.
Monday, Monday by the Mamas and the Papas, the classic Californian sound of the 1960s, those harmonies, we love to hear it. This was a late inclusion for me in my top five. Funnily though, because it was one of the first songs that I did think of, but I just kind of put it on the back burner for a while. I'm a moderate fan of the Mamas and the Papas, I would say. Craig, what about you? You a fan?
Same. I couldn't call myself a fan just because I couldn't start listing off, like, you know, album tracks and stuff. But when the Mamas and the Papas come on, I do love it. Like,
yeah. And this is from their first album from 1966. And what I found fascinating, I didn't know this before, was that the Wrecking Crew were their band. So they played on this. Yeah. So Hal Blaine, like, is on drums. There's some like funny little kind of anecdotes about it where Denny Doherty, who sang the vocals for this song, he really didn't like this song. He said when they recorded it, he was like, nobody likes Monday. So I thought it was just a song about the working man. Nothing about it stood out to me. It was a dumb fucking song, which I think is so funny to be so like passive aggressive about like such a sweet and otherwise like warm and buoyant song. John Phillip says that he wrote the song in about 20 minutes, which I also think, like, not to be dismissive of the song, but I do think it sounds like it was quickly put together just because, like, it has those, like, sweeping kind of chords and all that kind of stuff.
It's very easy to kind of connect the dots in terms of the melodies and the kind of lyrical. Like, when you hear Tom York talk about how, like, Street Spirit, I wrote that in, like, 10 minutes, you're like, oh, come on, did you really? Or are you just making some mythic thing of, like... But, you know, you can totally hear this just kind of arriving with, a few strums and a chord.
Kind of, like, jamming it out, like, backstop. But what I found also quite funny about this, so... This is the album, of course, where the artwork is where they're all in the bath. You know that one?
Okay.
Yeah, so it was initially quite controversial because because it showed the band sitting in a bathtub. And the controversial thing about it, and the record was actually pulled from stores because there was a toilet visible on the cover, which people found offensive. And then there was a second iteration of the artwork where California Dreaming is written quite big over the toilet, so you can't really see it as much. And it went on to have five different versions of the artwork because of the toilet.
Controversial. This was running through my head throughout the week. I do like this song. It's really pleasant to listen to. And what I always kind of liked about it, though, but I didn't really dig deep into it, was lyrically, it's like that pleasant thing of a Monday. It's like doing the opposite of what you would expect a Monday song to do, right? So it's not like the kind of what a drag it is. It's kind of weirdly kind of ironic in its cheeriness. I think it was used in like a lotto ad as well, wasn't it? Wasn't it like an Irish lotto ad where it's someone that's like quit their job because they've won and they're on like a yacht or something? And it's Monday. That's my, you know, abiding memory of this song.
And then my final little bit of trivia about it is that Monday was the first Hot 100 chart topper with a day in the week in its title, and the only one with Monday. Manic Monday by the Bangles and Rainy Days and Mondays by the Carpenters both stalled at number two. So there you go. It's the only successful Monday song.
That's interesting. And a very, early days for kind of days of the week songs. Because I was thinking, you know, I was thinking going in there would be a lot of contenders, or at least like qualified songs. But I found the truly great ones were a bit thin on the ground. There's something about like lyrically going to a day of the week, I think, that it's kind of an easy songwriting shorthand. It just lets you start listing things like days of the week. Kind of might, you know, encourage a certain laziness. So there's a lot of those kind of songs. And speaking of laziness, I went with as my number five. This was inspired by Zara being all like, you know, carpe diem, seize the day. So I went with a very familiar song to fans of this show. It's the Strokes. That's me living in the moment there. Why are Sundays so depressing? My boys, the New Abnormal. Lazy because I had a clip from when this album featured in our albums of the year 2020. So there was that. But you know what? I would have been lying to myself if I didn't include it, because I think this is, along with The Adults Are Talking, my most played song from The New Abnormal, which is by now my most played Strokes album. I throw on this all of the time, which I'm kind of a bit shocked by. Real return to form for The Strokes. I think this is a great example of them recapturing, I think the fair to say, the coolness that they'd somewhat lost over the years, where they just, like, things weren't quite working out for them. Every songwriting session, recording session, you know, and the resulting album seemed labored, and Julian was bringing in his quite strange ideas from the Voids, and the rest of the band weren't kind of simpatico with that. This is finally the sound of a band starting to incorporate new ideas, finally. And there's a kind of looseness to this that weren't on the first two records. And there's that kind of wah, wah, wah thing, which I think actually works somehow, testament to the song. But it also being kind of quintessentially Strokesian in terms of, it just sounds very New York, it sounds very cool, incorporates Julian's falsetto in a really cool, breezy way. And it's kind of, it's the sound of, it's like a post-hangover sound to me. It's like shaking something off. It's not a grim Sunday song. I'm including it even though when it came out, it was Why Are Sundays apostrophe S so depressing. Yes. It infuriated me for like a week. This was up on Spotify. I just hate when nouns are mistakenly made possessive. That's my own problem. I need to get over it. I do think it's a great, great song. And it does that like 1251 thing of like a guitar line that sounds like it could be a synth line, which is quite like Blondie's new wave kind of style back in late 70s, early 80s. It's just cool. It's great. It's got the, you know, the click was always a new fab thing going on. And yeah, it's louche. It's cheeky. It's my number five.
Yeah, that's a great shout. I actually completely forgot about this song. But during the week when I was like trying to pick my top five and I was trying to like rattle my brain as to like bands who would have like days of the week that I need to like check, double check, The Strokes was one that I was like, oh, The Strokes definitely have a day of the week song. And I was like, okay, I must check that out. And then I just forgot and then I finalized on my top five. But the New Abnormal was an album that I was really pleasantly surprised by. I quite enjoyed that. And I didn't expect the lads to make such a buoyant return, which was great.
Yeah, for sure.
So no, really glad to hear them, your boys. Okay, today's Friday for the listener.
Cheer up, Sarah. It's like phase two of the hangover kicking in hour number two of the podcast. Go on.
Yeah, thanks, Craig. So it's Friday for the listener, not for us, it's Thursday. So to add another day into the mix, let's all look forward to getting into Saturday night.
Oh, wow.
Down in the cold, and you're dreaming of them Saturdays that came before it's found you stumbling. Stumbling onto the heart of Saturday night. Stumbling, stumbling onto the heart of Saturday night.
So that was Tom Waits, Looking for the Heart of Saturday Night, which of course is the titular track of his second album from 1974. I saw Licorice Pizza last week in the cinema, which is very good. Highly recommend. Didn't know that Tom Waits was in it. It's a spoiler. Yeah. If you're listening to this and didn't know that, I'm very sorry. He crops up and he's like brilliant in it. Just such an amazing person to watch and just so captivating.
Yeah.
And him just being in my mind the last couple of days, having seen the film, immediately made me think of this song. I was like, oh, savage, like I have this, that's gonna be my top five. And what I love about it is I love how it's very like sentimental, it's a really sweet melody, it's really mournful. And even though it's like the song title would make you think that it's going to be like, and it is like a celebration of like remembered Saturday nights with your friends and the ceremony of like combing your hair and giving yourself a little shave like before you hopefully get the smooch. what I
getting on your white disco boots. Yeah, I remember it well, Zara. We'll get back there someday.
One day. But I love how like there's such a communal kind of aspect to the stories that he shares in this song, but the arrangement is just so lilting and it's, as I said, it's really mournful. And I just love how, even though it's a communal thing and we all think of Saturday nights possibly with our friends and memories of that, I feel that the execution of this song is so solitary and it's so, he's just saying so alone. And listening to this song kind of repeatedly during the week was a real kind of highlight. Also kind of sounds like The Hangover has really hit in for Tom Waits as well after all these Saturday nights. But yeah, it's a very beautiful song and I could not have it on my list.
It's a great song. I love it. He's in peak kind of Barfly mode at this stage and still kind of early career. Hasn't quite moved into his most distinctive, I guess, you know, creatively out there mode as yet, but I loved the debut record and then all the 70s stuff is great. He kind of hasn't really put a foot wrong. A friend of the show, Carlo, I know, is a huge Tom Waits fan and he shared a playlist with me ages ago. I was already into Tom Waits, but it was a nice way into stuff I hadn't got to, which was great. And I deeply angered him over the Christmas because I spent the Christmas post Get Back getting into a lot of Paul McCartney solo stuff. which was great, particularly around like New Year's, where you're like not up to much and you're just going for like runs and being healthy, and you're listening to Ram, which is just like country Paul. It's great. It's good for the soul. I was very excited about Paul McCartney being a lovely guy and inventing like every musical genre ever. And I sent Carlo a message where it was like Monkberry Moon Delight. And I was just like, this is just Paul casually inventing Tom Waits. And Carlo's like, listen, we could say about every other invention, like we can give that to Paul McCartney, but we can't give him Tom Waits, which is fair enough. Tom Waits is his own man. Tom Waits for no man. Said jokes are as made recently, which is amazing. And a great, amazing pick. And let's move on to my number four. It's enough carefree fun for me. Here's another song that doesn't actually mention the day in the lyrics. It's another kind of recent-ish one as well. Here it is. Here's my number four. Do you make jokes and you laugh? Cause you know, despite all the sadness, that you better get the good times while they last. Now every new word that they speak, you are already feeling like it's in the past. And when they are gone, you just try to move on, cause the memory's hurting too bad. I've grown up so much and I wonder who you'd have become if you stuck for a while. Just know that I love you, your brain ain't forget you. Now when I remember, I smile. But I guess I'd say I'll see you soon. I see you soon. It's Run the Jewels. It's Thursday in the Danger Room. It's not the greatest Thursday song. That is the Pet Shop Boys, but I've picked them before, so some rules can't be broken, and you can go listen to that in your own time. This is an amazing song, though. It's probably the best track on Run the Jewels 3, I reckon, from 2016. Penultimate track, and certainly at the time, their most kind of open and personal song, and they're not really dueling LP and Mike in terms of trading bars, but thematically it's similar, just them talking about kind of losses, different kind of losses they've suffered. And as always, there's some social commentary in there. It's really, there's just some amazing lines in there. It's a bit of a choker, but also, two things. It just is a great gliding vibe because you've Kamasi Washington on it with his incredible kind of cosmic sax, which just works so well here. And it's like, it's basically a ballad. It's thought-provoking. It's a tearjerker. But the beat is so great as well that you can kind of bounce along to it. It just is this strange hybrid thing. Like, it's something new, I think, for Run the Jewels at that moment in time. And, you know, some of the conversation we've had about them is like, can they be a bit one note? Are they a kind of, you know, AC/DC of, you know, kind of conscious rap in terms of they are in one lane and they do it better than anyone else, but they don't really deviate, you know, too far away from it. I think this is a slight deviation while still having their DNA. And it's, yeah, it's great. It's, yeah, sorry, Zara, go on.
No, no, it was just a great pick. I remember, I think I reviewed this album with you guys.
Yeah. Over 5 years ago now? Oh my God.
Oh my God.
We've been doing this show too long.
Yeah. But I remember not really having many highlights from that album. And that clip there has just kind of reminded me to go back and check that album out again. So
yeah, it was, you know, it's a good record. I think when we reviewed the fourth, we were saying it felt like the moment when, were they kind of out of things to say? This was like, okay, they're doing something a bit different, but the rest of it wasn't quite sustaining it. And it's pretty, it's good quality. I think the fourth is probably superior, but yeah, there's some absolute gems and this is one of them. That's my number four.
I won. Okay. It's my number three now. I mean, where to even begin with this? And okay, I actually should preface that I was anxious about my top five all day, and it's because, Craig, as you would say to me, I went a bit too discerning, I think.
Okay.
So this is the moment, I think, on my top five where things just take off into like a kind of left turn.
I'm excited.
Where Friday's Child is my number three, but there's a few songs called Friday's Child, and it's perhaps not the Friday's Child that you would think it would be.
Oh my God. Okay. So it's not Lee?
No.
Nancy?
No.
Neither?
No.
What is it? Play the clip. You got something that they all want to know. You gotta hold on
stop. Yeah, so that was actually Van Morrison and Ben's version.
What have you done? What have you done?
Oh, Craig, so much. Yeah, I'm actually, I have the shakes again. They've just returned. I got rid of them and they're back now.
Do you know how relieved I am? Because I was dreadfully afraid of the day when I would probably have to pick like Sweet Thing in a top five and then talk about Justifying Van Morrison. And you've now set a precedent, so it's grand. It's fine. It's open season on all of his admittedly great stuff. Yeah, it's a lovely version. Doing a great song as well. I knew the song was I had like the Lee version in my shortlist and I was like,
this isn't the same song at all.
Oh, it's not actually.
Yeah, no, it's completely.
It's actually, yeah, it's totally different.
It's totally different, yeah. So this was recorded by them in 1965. So them were obviously the rock group that Van Morrison was originally with. They formed in 1964. They were more so regarded as a live band, and that was kind of in part because a lot of the time Van Morrison, when he was singing on stage, would ad-lib, and songs like Gloria, their best-known hit, would turn into these like 20 minute opuses. Your boys, The Doors and Jim Morrison in particular, were massive fans of them. And there was a point where them had a residency at the famous Whiskey Go Go in LA. And in the final week of their residency, The Doors actually opened for them, which would have been a nice little double bill.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a kind of controversial take now. I don't,
you love
think,
The Doors?
No, I don't love The Doors.
Major problem with Licorice Pizza, by the way, inclusion of The Doors, the most controversial thing about that film on my viewing. Anyway, sorry Zara.
I obviously can appreciate that Van Morrison, as we hear that song, is, I think it's an incredible song. His vocals are amazing, especially when he's like howling that you can't stop now, and that growl like leading up to the chorus. It's just great. I have always, since I was about a teenager, always preferred his work with them than his solo work. And I'm not including Greatest Record Project Volume 1 in that. I'm kind
glad
of more
you noted that. I don't know the Dem stuff at all, really, which clearly, because I was just like, oh, he's doing a really interesting interpretation of this Lee Hazel. As he's just vamping with his vocals, I'm like, wow, he's taking it in strange new directions. So maybe I need to acquaint myself with Dem a bit more.
I used to listen to them a lot more when I was younger. I haven't really done it recently outside of like Here Comes the Night, which obviously is an amazing song. Gloria is great. Of course, this song I just think is phenomenal. But there's just something about the kind of rawness and the unbridled nature of Morrison's performances across the songs. And maybe that is because they did feel foremost as a live band as opposed to a record band. They've always kind of said that they were never really as happy with their records as they were, or as they could have been, or maybe should have been. And I also just wanted to kind of explore the morgue a bit more with the top five and have people that I haven't had before, and also maybe listeners haven't heard this song before, so it's a good like insight and introduction.
Yeah, I'm going to have a proper listen after the show. So in that regard, a good inclusion. Although now I'm thinking of like, I didn't put Morrissey in this list because of some of the things he said. And maybe every day like someone I should be in. Anyway, my number three. My number three is, yeah, it's a song where it just kind of lists in days. The singer, the songwriter was like, I don't think anyone's done this before. They were doing it in the 60s, but I don't know if anyone did it better than this. Best Got Lads, The Cure, Friday I'm in Love. And Robert Smith has an interesting relationship with this song. It came out in 1992. I think it was the end of their like purple patch of like really bright, massive pop hits. And he said before that it's interesting that they're kind of portrayed as these gloomy goth types, when like the guy, you know, the taxi driver, or like the person on the street, knows him as the bloke that sings Friday I'm in Love, which is really chirpy. And depending on the kind of year or the interview, he will give a different opinion on this song. So he'll say it's kind of completely dumb. He'll say that like it's just, he doesn't have any time for it whatsoever. And then there's interviews where he says it's one of my three favorite Cure singles ever. And he says actually it was harder writing the dumb lyrics. So he came up with the song when he'd been in the pub with the lads, which is very Robert Smith. And it was a Friday and he was very excited about it being Friday. And he was like, hey guys, has anyone ever done like the days of the week? Which they definitely done. And he's like, oh no, I feel really good about this idea. I'm going to write this song, like taking that kind of journey. And he had this chord progression, which is magnificent. And he's like, I was convinced that this was a different song. It was very much like the Paul McCartney Yesterday thing of like him ringing people up and playing it and being like, have you heard this song before? Does this exist? And everyone's like, no, no, no. So it kind of, yeah, apparently just fell into place, tumbled into place. It was like a Monday thing. And here it is. And it's great. I love the kind of glistening like guitars. It's almost like a kind of birds thing going on along with those keys. It just totally floats as a song. You need to kind of be in the mood for it. I was thinking, is this very, very obvious? And then when I put it on, I'm like, no, this has kind of improved my day. Has to be in. The Cure are great. The Cure for life. Robert Smith over Morrissey. Oh, so yeah, he takes my third spot.
Very nice. This was a song that I did think of. Kind of like you, I did think, oh, is it a bit like cheesy or is it a bit obvious? But then when you But then when you listen to it, there's just so much fun in it. And it is kind of like not the most classic Cure sounding song as well, which just makes it a bit more endearing for like what they were trying to do. And I always love a good Robert Smith meme, so excellent shout, a very Craig shout, and I'm glad of it. Okay, so my silver medal this week. Okay, Craig, this is another moment where things are a bit controversial. So my number two.
God knows where we're going now.
My number two is a song called Sunday Morning, but it's not the Sunday morning that
you may have expected. Okay, okay.
Adam, take it away. Sunday Morning by Margot Gurian.
I sense we're still in the 60s. Would that be correct?
68. So the year after the Velvet's Velvet's Own Sunday Morning. This song, I had been really intrigued by this album. So do you know much about Margot Gurian?
I know absolutely nothing about her, no.
Okay. It's an album that I think you will really enjoy, Craig. You may even know the album artwork. She was a one and done, basically. She had a 1968 album called Take a Picture. This song featured on it, but it was kind of more so known as a hit for Spanky and Our Gang. It was also covered by Bobby Gentry and Glen Campbell. They did a version of it in 1968. And there's kind of parts of the arrangement where it really fits in with Bobby Gentry's style. I must dig out any kind of footage of that performance. I'd say it's class. So basically, she was born in New York. She studied jazz piano at Boston University. And she just really wanted to be a songwriter. She never had a lot of confidence in her voice, which is kind of really surprising because I really like her voice across the album, but especially on that song. It's got that kind of real 60s breathy tone. tone to it. Also sounds very like, you know, Melody's Echo Chamber. Sounds like she was very influenced, I think, by this album. And yeah, I just really liked this song. I thought it'd be another kind of different kind of twist as opposed to going for the easy ones.
Bit pointed there, but
no shade.
Like, you know, The Cure. I can sense that I'm gonna love this song. Vocally, yeah, I was in like the realms of like Vashti Bunyan or something like that. But it's like folk meets, like, there's definitely kind of hints of R&B in there, like a Fifth Dimension, just kind of like psychedelic R&B thing. So it's, yeah, right up my street.
Yeah, the album is brilliant. I highly recommend you check that out. But she kind of just had the one album. She continued to write songs. Harry Belafonte recorded one of her songs. She was really inspired, actually, before this album. She heard God Only Knows on Pet Sounds, and that really shook up her approach to songwriting and composition. She just really liked the kind of pop aspect to it, but she didn't tour a lot. She didn't want to be famous. She didn't want to be a touring musician, and she kind of lay dormant then for a while, and then she was rediscovered in the 90s, and that album Take a Picture became a bit of a cult classic, if you will.
Okay. Definitely one to check out. And here comes Mr. Obvious with his runner-up. Sunday morning, it's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around. It's nothing at all. When I was contemplating on Wednesday night cutting a clip of Charles Mingus's Wednesday night prayer meeting, I was like, oh, I should have gone ahead with it, you know. I was like, is this too clever? Had to go with the Velvets. It's the Velvet Underground. It's Sunday morning. I adore this song. Really relaxing, reassuring song about drug paranoia.
Yeah.
And the story, do you know what I love the most about the Velvets is that, like, despite all the kind of myth around them and the Lou Reed image and stuff, they were kind of sellouts from the start. This was a song, it was like the final song recorded for the Velvet Underground and Nico, and it was like, you know, a request where I think Tom Wilson just told Lou Reed, you need another song with Nico singing, and it has to be possibly, you know, a big single. Spoilers, it wasn't, and spoilers, Nico didn't sing it. Lou Reed was so enamored with it, he's like, I'll just sing this one. So Nico singing kind of backing vocals in a really great Nico bit of trivia. She thought it was Sunday morning, as in sun, then day, then MOURNING, which is like her version would have been so dark. And instead we get this like beautiful thing of like John Cale playing the like Celesta kind of thing. It's just twinkling. It's very like, I do like that debut record. There's some great songs on it, but I find myself just gravitating with the Velvets way more towards the like kind of childlike pop songs. Basically, I think Lou Reed invented like twee, like indie rock or indie pop. He is the man who created it all. Aside from all the like the heroin kind of, you know, waiting for the man, just out and out rockers and the black leather and the kind of the fetish parties and all that, he just invented twee. And those are the songs that I listen to. I'll Be Your Mirror and, you know, I'm Sticking With You. I think they were his best stuff. His solo career stuff has a really gorgeous, distorted, like lullaby quality to them. And this is one of the best examples of this. So it's just, yeah, it's about a dark thing. It's, you know, Andy Warhol was like, write a song about coming off the drugs. And this is what Lou Reed came up with. And it's beautiful.
Yeah, and I do think, like, I love this song. I do love it. And it's one that, like, I think I would gravitate to the most when I want to just stick on a Velvet song, especially when I'm walking. I love listening to this when I'm walking, because I think that just the mood and the instrumentation of the song just really reminds me of the long gone days of when you'd be at like a house party and you might stay until like 5 a.m. or something, and you come out and the street is bright, it's like morning and it has that lovely kind of pastely blue and you can see like the moon in the sky. That's what this song like really perfectly captures for me. And I just love Lou's voice in it as well. It's very sweet.
All right, Zara, it's time. Are we going to be in for a shock? What's your number one?
Oh, we are. Okay, God.
I think so.
Do you want to give us an intro or are we just going to get straight in?
So it's another song that focuses on Sunday mornings, but one Sunday morning in particular, Adam.
Outside I look lived in, like the moon's in a shrine. How am I forgiven? Oh, I'll give it time.
So that was One Sunday Morning, parentheses, song for Jane Smiley's Boyfriend by Wilco, features on their 2011 album The Whole Love. This is a kind of late addition to my top five. It was when I was doing my Wilco, they have a song surely with Days of the Weeks in it, and actually The Whole Love is not one of their albums that I go to a lot. It's one I actually kind of overlook a lot, but I've been really enjoying getting stuck into it this week. This song closes the album out. It's 12 minutes long and it kind of ruminates on that very tender instrumentation you hear of the soft guitar picking. It's got lovely vibraphone on it as well, which really kind of adds to the buoyancy, which is an interesting kind of counter to the lyrical content. So Jane Smiley is an American writer. She's a novelist. She won a Pulitzer Prize in 1992 for her book, A Thousand Acres. And the song is written from the perspective of her boyfriend, who has an overbearing religious father. So the lyrics are quite heavy. Like there's a lot of weight to like the imagery and the relationship that is kind of described between this guy and his father. And obviously as well, Tweedy's voice is really, really intimate in this song. And it has like such a softness that like I found that whenever I was listening to it, I was like really like drawn closer to his words and like really trying to pay as close attention to him. So yeah, I just loved that kind of counter of the buoyant and bright instrumentation with the lyrics. And it's probably, I think, one of Wilco's most beautiful songs of all time.
I would agree. Yeah, hearing it after Sunday Morning, it's almost like a kind of descendant of that, really. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's living in the same universe just in terms of what the lyrics are doing, but then just the kind of almost hypnotic beauty of this kind of twilight sunrise moment of magic. And I adore the song. I picked it as one of mine, and I'm trying to remember the list. It was either long songs or it was like tribute songs or something like that. And I think it's one of their masterpieces. I think it gets a little slept on, so I'm really glad to hear it here. And yeah, I think it works really well in terms of where it's positioned. For my number one, probably keeping it very Craig, Captain Craig anyway. We're bookending my top five with The Strokes and the greatest Scottish band of all time, Zara.
Yes, go, the Blue Nile.
Go on, take it away, Adam.
Meet me outside. She loved me all the way.
It's Saturday night. It's the Boon Isle. It's the closer from Hats. It was the final single from that record. It was their highest charter at like number 50 in the UK or something. And it's such a magical band. I am often want to stick this on round about the time mentioned on the Saturday in question in the lyrics, like an absolute knobhead, because it just does something really special. Like, it really works for that time. It sounds like that time of the day and kind of like, you know, the tranquility of a Saturday afternoon and the promise of a Saturday night. I don't know what I'm doing anymore, but Paul Buchanan is an absolute legend, a genius. It seems like in his own quiet way, he is getting more online in the last year or so and maybe hinting at having new songs, which would be tremendous. No longer with the Blue Nile. They have ceased to be a band, but my God, released, what, 4 records, and all of them are kind of various degrees of perfect. This is the most perfect, if there is such a thing. It's Hats. It's just one, to my ears, one of the greatest albums of all time. And yeah, it's just about, what do the Blue Nile do? I guess they just like amplify the super ordinary. They make like, you know, doing the dishes in like a Glasgow kitchen feel like this Hollywood moment or something. And as a band, and I don't know if Paul Buchanan still does it, but they would cover like Strangers in the Night quite a lot. Like, he would often go to old standards and kind of swoon-worthy songs, and you can hear that in his voice. And, you know, when he's singing about like The Ordinary Girl or whatever in this, it's total pure croonerism, fantastical stuff, but like rooted in something really ordinary and everyday. And yeah, that's the Blue Nile. Check them out. I'm sure like everyone that listens to this podcast at this point is like, stop talking about the Blue Nile. We already listened to them. But yeah, they're great. Like, there's a Paul Buchanan quote where he was asked about like making records and how long it takes. And he's like, he compared making an album to falling in love. It's like, you can't do it every year. Apparently you can't do it every decade either. But hopefully maybe next year we'll all fall in love again with a Paul Buchanan record, and that'd be a beautiful thing.
Yeah, no, this is such an incredible shout and an amazing number one. I think I've discovered or came to the Blue Nile through the show, actually. The story of when you and Dale were on the bus.
Oh yeah, don't bring up that story.
When you guys were on the bus back from Oxygen, maybe, or Electric Picnic.
Yeah, Picnic, I think it was our first picnic together.
In a really cute friend move, you shared headphones and the downtown lights.
Yeah,
a song that like
I did a Garden State "This Song Will Change Your Life" thing on the bus back from Picnic, and it did change Dave's life. I don't know.
It changed my life. Once I listened to the Downtown Lights for the very first time, I was just completely sold. And the other day, actually, my friends and I were talking about the Blue Nile and how incredible Hats is. And one of my friends said that there's an amazing documentary, a radio documentary, I think, about the Blue Nile, possibly by
Ken Sweeney put it together, and it is absolutely phenomenal. Yeah, he went to Glasgow and talked to Paul, and it works really well in that kind of that radio doc context. You know what I mean? Your kind of imagination runs away with you, and it's kind of nice and I don't know, low stakes in a really winning way. It's very endearing. So yeah, people should check that out. In Search of the Blue Nile, I believe it's called. And it's Ken Sweeney. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have that bookmarked now. I'll listen to that today when I'm washing some dishes now after recording with you, Craig.
The best way to do it. And yeah, everyone go and do that after this episode. We hope this episode has been life-changing for you, listener. Zara, has it changed at least your hangover status or your Thursday night?
Yes, yeah, I don't
feel
hungover anymore. The stress has been lifted off my shoulder.
Well, we have reached the end.
You and Adam.
It's been great. It's been a nice return, as good as it could have been without our main man, Dave, who will be back next week. And if he's listening, we love you, Dave. If he's made it this far, we love you doubly. But yeah, Zara, any final plugs? Or come on, you're very, you know, everyone should just go and read everything Zara does because it's always great. But yes.
Oh, thanks so much. You can do that.
And yeah. Oh, on that bombshell, This episode of No Encore was engineered by the gifted, handsome sonic architect Adam Shanahan. And if you want to help out the show, it's patreon.com. It's /No Encore. We will be back next year, 2023. We'll have another episode for you. No, next week. Be there or be square, because Dave will be. This has been No Encore. I've been Craig Fitzpatrick. I will be next week. There will be No Encore next week. Peace out, guys. Bye.